You are listening to the Personal Development Project, an initiative seeking to find ourselves and our path to make being us just that little bit easier. So today I'm joined with two good friends to have a conversation on the ego. And I think this is perhaps one of the most important conversations I can have on this quest of personal development. For me, this conversation was a schooling in self-image and in self-talk. And when so much of what we do is about coming to grips with that self, accepting that self, and seeing if there are any tweaks we can make to make being us just a little bit easier, I think a conversation about our ego, a conversation about our very essence, is essential. So that's what we'll get into for the next hour or so. Enjoy. This is the 14th episode now of the Personal Development Podcast. The first one I'm recording in Bristol. And I'm joined with Roshan and Adam to speak a little bit about the ego. So Roshan, do you want to introduce yourself first? How you know me and why you're here with us?
Yeah, I'm Roshan. I know Eunice just through mutual friends at uni. He asked me to come on and... so here I am.
Yeah. I had the first conversation with Roshan that gave me the whole idea. I guess I had the first conversation with my sister, but we'll get into that. And then I had the best conversation with Roshan that gave me the idea to have this episode. And Adam?
Yeah. Thank you, Eunice. Well, I think we have a lot of mutual friends and it took us until fourth year to really get to know each other, but... here we are, and I think I might be the first philosophy student you've had on your podcast. Correct me if I'm wrong, so we're in for a treat.
They're all engineers. Adam knows a lot of the engineers I've had on here. But yeah, almost everyone before this has been an engineer or a scientist. Or my sister and a family friend. But yeah, if we kick it off, I wanted to... talk today about the ego, because I seem to be hearing more and more about it, and I seem to have more and more comments about my ego, about other people's egos, about strengths and weaknesses. And it did start my whole awareness of it. I'd say I've no resentment for this, but a few years ago when my sister made the comment that I had a particularly large ego. And I didn't quite know what that meant, but I spent a lot of time trying to get rid of it. And there were negatives and positives to that. And I'd been contemplating quite a bit. And I took the question to Roshan a couple of months ago. And I believe I asked you to talk to me about the male ego.
Yeah.
And you had an interesting response.
I had a lot to say. I mean, so when you first came to me and said about the male ego, I think I was talking about how I believe that men, like from the start, from the get-go, intrinsically have a more secure and, well, therefore bigger ego than girls. Just because of the way the world works. And I think from the get-go, men are... safer and so have more space to build their sense of ego and their sense of self compared to what a girl compared to what a girl can go through. And
I already love the way you phrase that, because I can see a lot there already. Men are more secure, you said, and that almost creates, am I correct in interpreting this, a domain for them to work on their ego a bit more, or to have a bit more of an established ego.
Yeah, for sure. I think as a girl, you're constantly having to fight to get yourself heard more. Mm-hmm. And you're also having to fight to feel safer. And that just gives you less time to think about yourself, mm-hmm. which is why it's often the case that girls are more emotional, because mm-hmm. they don't have that sense of self there that men might do already.
Okay. So are there differences, would you say, between the male and the female ego?
Yeah, I think so. But obviously I don't know what it's like to be a man. But yeah. I don't know whether it's just men project their sense of self more, or men project their ego more. But I think it's a lot more common as a girl to see a man as more secure and safer in themselves than we are.
Because that's interesting. I'll pose this question to you, Adam, but the more conversations I've had and the more I've looked into it, a lot of people have been telling me that it's actually the male ego that is the most fragile, and hence maybe why men draw upon an almost false sense of confidence so much to deal with manhood. What's your experience with that, Adam? How would you describe the male ego?
Well, firstly, I think it's clear that when we're talking about ego, we're talking about something that seems negative.
Mm.
And I think as this conversation develops, we'll realise that it's not necessarily a negative thing. Mm. I think I'd disagree with Roshan on one point. I'd agree that men are certainly more egotistic, but I don't think that that's a product of their circumstance. I'd say that it's a part of their personality.
Mm-hmm.
I think the personality differences between men and women are really the origin of this. And when we talk about men being egotistical or egocentric, clearly it's because they act in their self-interest. They put themselves first.
Mm.
They're disagreeable. They're stubborn. Whereas women, on the other hand, we might say are agreeable. And so we wouldn't say that they have an inflated sense of self. They don't have an ego. Whether or not this is because men are compensating for a kind of anxiety, I think that's... I don't think there's any evidence to say that. But it's clear that some men do compensate.
You don't think men are necessarily overcompensating, you were saying?
No, not necessarily.
Not necessarily.
There is a stereotype of a kind of man which has an inflated sense of self because they're lacking in other areas. but on the whole, I don't think it's fair to say that all men are like this.
Okay. That is interesting, because in my experience, I would actually say my ego can help me compensate for a lack within.
Mm.
Because a lot of my experience, I'm not necessarily going to brandish this as the male experience, but a lot of my experience and how I'm naturally inclined and how I'm told to be male is to kind of be the doer, to be competent. And I think a lot of these inclinations or demands maybe come before I have the innate ability or I have the innate confidence. In a lot of occasions, my ego kind of mediates that. If I only get 90% there, say being the most confident, being the guy that goes up and does X, Y, and Z, I can draw upon my ego. And it's almost like a little conversation with myself that's like, right, Eunice, you've got this. You did X, Y, and Z. You are Eunice. You are this. You are that. Of course you can do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I almost, it's like I'm looking in the mirror at a construct that is Eunice to try and be like, just act how he acts, think how he thinks, and he will get you there. And I can convince myself to adopt the extra Eunice, the extra oomph, and get that over the line. And I think that can sometimes be misconstrued with arrogance, because you think so much of yourself. You are a go-getter, you are an enabler, and you can afford to indulge and be a bit more egocentric. And is that what you were kind of getting at? Sometimes that's what you can deal with.
But I don't, when
you're dealing with the male ego.
I don't think, so like you said, you were kind of looking in the mirror. I don't think the person on the other side of the mirror that you're calling for help from, I don't think that's your ego.
Okay.
I think you, Eunice, talking to the person in the mirror, I think that's your ego. That's your sense of self. And you're drawing on something else that's not necessarily you as a person.
Yes.
For that extra support.
Yes. And that's not the ego that I'm drawing on.
I don't think you're drawing on your ego.
Because that's how I've internalized it. And I've had people say, yeah, that's spot on. And I've had people also say, I think what you're saying.
Yeah, I think your sense of self is how you feel you truly are as a person. And I think that person in the mirror is a part of you that you don't necessarily believe is the true you, but you can draw upon for help when you need it. I don't think that's your ego.
So what is the ego? Literally just the sense of self.
Yeah, I think your ego is you when you're calm. And you when there's no other externalities. I think your ego is what you would be if there was no one else around and there was no other external like inputs, external stimuli.
Okay. But then I'd ask what, to both of you perhaps, what are people getting at when you do think about the stereotypical male ego? Is that the man or is this some other part?
Yeah, I think it's a, I don't think the part that, I don't think what men project onto the world is necessarily their ego. I think it's a sense of confidence and maybe a separate part. I think a man's sense of self is something that you don't really get to see.
No,
I don't think so. Not as much as we think.
Well, it's become colloquial to say that someone who's arrogant and self-important and acts in their own self-interest has a big ego. But what we were talking about just now, about what the ego really is or what it should be, is what ego used to mean. This idea of just the abstract self, the thing which underlies all of your experience. So the fact that now it's taken on a new meaning, and it is inseparable to this idea of arrogance, I think it's unfortunate, because you know, people go around calling people egotistical and having a big ego, when perhaps what they mean is that they're just being selfish. And I think we're all selfish from time to time. It doesn't necessarily mean that we have an inflated sense of self, and it would be damaging to go around telling people that they're self-important when perhaps we've been a bit quick to judge.
Which is, I think, how I took it when my sister first told me I had a big ego, because it hurts. I think it's one of the sharpest daggers you could issue at a man, because it certainly caused me a bit of internal conflict, because a lot of times I do genuinely just feel like I'm being me, but I kind of feel like, again, there's this man in the mirror, there's this part of me that I need to draw upon to get over some of those hurdles. And it's interesting, Adam, you were talking about people use that phrase, the ego, when people are being selfish or thinking about themselves a lot. And I'm thinking, Roshan, you were talking about how in your experience you've seen females don't necessarily have as much of that option to sit there and think about themselves and bolster their ego. Where does that come from?
I think as a woman you're constantly, well, there's always that pressure of feeling safe and feeling insecure, I don't think you have as much time to yourself to develop your own ego, because I think it's so shaped by the externalities of the world and how we're expected to be as women. I think my sense of self is quite small, but having a big ego, I think, is something that I would strive for. If we use ego really? In the traditional sense, it's you without... It's you when you're not being affected by anything or anyone. It's you being able to be you and not letting what people say and what people think of you have any effect on you as a person, yourself. And it's being able to draw on yourself when you're distressed.
Yes.
Or, like you said, when you needed that confidence boost. I think having a sense of self that is able to say, no, okay, I can manage this for myself without having to go to other people, without having to do things and self-soothe with things that aren't you.
I think
that's what having a big ego is. And I think that is something that people should strive for a bit more.
Okay. I find that very interesting, because I've been working and I've been speaking to friends who have been like me, kind of thinking, actually, the ego is the enemy. You want as small an ego as possible. And I think potentially that is because of the, I don't know, disjunctive meaning that we were talking about how there's different labels for egos. But that last statement that you said kind of does take me back to the conversation we did have about how I hadn't thought like this before, but there are, the ego is almost reactionary to circumstance, to situation, to things that happen. And what were you saying about that, about almost different selves that are created within yourself?
Yeah, so how I like to think of things is I have myself, my true self, which I think is my ego, which is me that's not affected by the outside world, and me that doesn't need anything else. It's me when I'm calm. It's me when there's no one else around. But there are these parts of you that build up over time, and they can it's almost like they're born. Someone says something to you that you've never heard before, and this part of you is born. And over time, as more and more things happen in the outside world, this part grows and grows and grows. And I think that kind of, there are these parts of you that form. Yeah. And they can be positive or negative. I think their role in you is to protect the self and to protect you.
Yes.
But I think they can develop in negative ways.
Do they seem to have a tendency to develop more negatively than positively? Because after you kind of exposed me to this way of thinking, and I had to go and sit there and see it within myself and see these little parts of me, I definitely noticed that they seemed to be more negative.
Yeah, for sure. And I think a lot of the times when you have inner conflict, maybe, you can think of it as kind of these negative parts battling it with the positive parts. Like you said, when you were looking at your ego and thinking about your ego, there was this part of you that very much felt very confident and was comfortable feeling confident. But it sounds like there's this other negative part that's like, no, like, that's not okay. We need to stop that.
And the way you framed it to me the first time, I hope I've remembered this correctly, is say, yeah, we can run through the situation with my sister. Say my sister's just told me, she didn't quite say it like this, Eunice, you've got the fattest and most obnoxious ego I've ever seen in my life. And then I feel like there definitely was this part of me operating that was kind of, was it protection, as how you were saying?
Yeah, it's like a little...
wanted to stop me from going through that experience again.
Yeah.
So maybe when there was times of bolstered self-confidence, I'd be thinking, that little me would be thinking, oh, Eunice, you don't want to exhibit too much ego. You may come across as being self-centered, egotistical, and arrogant. And I saw that probably play strongest when it came to compliments. And
I'm still working on it. I've gotten a lot better. But people told me, like, I've never actually seen you, Eunice, look uncomfortable. But whenever someone compliments you, you kind of do just sit there and squirm in your skin and try and play it off. And after a while, maybe addressing that little part of myself, I had to realize, like, these compliments aren't actually negative. So there shouldn't be any negative reaction within me. But it was maybe that part of me, just again, not wanting to come across as cocky or arrogant or too egotistical. And you were saying you've had a lot of experience of those kind of chain reactions.
Yeah, as in, that sounds like it, that part literally was forming a blocker. Like, this feels like they can block out the compliments to try and not feed that part that knows it's very confident.
That's literally what would happen. I wouldn't let parts of my brain hear it.
Yeah, it's like this little thing jumped in and was like, no, like, that's not okay. I'm trying to think of some parts of myself that I've kind of come across and dealt with.
Yeah?
Yeah, I'm trying to think.
Maybe as you do that, Adam, how does that sound to you? Are there little mini Adams that have resulted? It seems much more easier for me to think of this as a result of trauma. I'll ask you about maybe some of the positive ones later on. But can you see that running through with yourself?
No, I personally don't view my kind of internal state in this way.
Mm-hmm.
I also don't think that there's a self which I don't portray to the world. I feel like the way I am is just, it's set. Going back to, I mean, you brought up this example of your sister saying you have a huge ego. I think to use ego in this derogatory way does show in part a misunderstanding, because
if
ego is something which is which acts in its own self-interest, this isn't necessarily a bad thing. Perhaps a better question would be to say, to what extent is acting in one's own self-interest a bad thing? Because, okay, if you're an impulsive person and you always act in your own self-interest, we can see why that might be bad, because it means that you don't consider other people, you want immediate gratification. So long-term is going to be bad. But if you're someone who looks at things long-term and values your relationships, then actually what's in your self-interest is going to be in other people's self-interest. So if you're in a relationship, what would be in your self-interest presumably would be what is in the interest of the relationship. But maybe it depends on the circumstance. So your ego, although it might act in its own self-interest, isn't necessarily going to be a bad thing. And I think anyone who doesn't put themselves first in any circumstance, well, they're certainly not going to be happy. And at least talking to you, Eunice, it seems like happiness is quite a important thing, or at least not just to you, but to all people. You think that, well, if you're not happy, if you don't aim for happiness, then there's not really much point in anything you do. So if the ego can help you attain that, then presumably that's a good thing.
That is very interesting, mainly because it's partly why I'm grateful for having these conversations. Contrary to kind of the view I came into this conversation with, which is that the acknowledgement of my ego and the rejection of parts of my ego do lend itself to proper happiness. And maybe if I take it back to that case with the little self that didn't want to be seen as egotistical, I think I'm not enjoying life to the fullest unless I'm just able to take compliments from people and able to admire those parts of myself wholly. Because it did seem like there were two contradictory messages. There was, I do think I'm quite a confident person, so when someone would pay me a compliment, part of me would be like, yeah, I know. Like, yeah, I know. It was good, or you were this, or you were that. And the other part of me, the vocal part, would kind of not know what to say and be rejecting it and be like, oh no, and da da da. And I had to, in the end, go to a friend and ask, okay, how do I deal with confidence? And they just said, just say yes and move on. And that's what I'd been doing. But for me, rejecting the ego initially, I think, did give me some humility. And then maybe if I'm looking through Roshan's lens, rejecting the reactionary mini self ego allowed me to fully appreciate things, just live a bit more. And that actually did give me happiness.
Not being able to take compliments or being uncomfortable when people compliment you.
Yeah.
I think, well, this isn't something which depends on one's ego. And already now I've noticed we're no longer talking about the male ego. We're just talking about this abstract, non-specific ego, because yeah. I'm sure there are plenty of women who don't like being complimented or don't know how yeah. to react. I personally wouldn't like to receive many compliments either.
Yeah.
It's just how I am. I don't think there's anything to do with my ego, because on the other hand, I've also been accused, like you, of being egotistical or arrogant or, you know, pompous, even, I think, one person called me.
What do you think, if I can interrupt you, what do you think they were getting at when they made those comments?
Definitely confidence. So, just in the way that I'd conduct myself or disagree with them, not be willing to just accept what they were saying, contesting their ideas, and the way in which I did this would come across as being incredibly arrogant.
Is it almost, I feel like I can relate, and the way I've looked at that is, what I almost hear people saying is, because you're not accepting what I'm saying, you must have such a level of self-assuredness that you view yourself and your points as better than mine, or you view yourself and your points as intrinsically correct. And that must be arrogant, because I feel like I've definitely battled with similar. And again, this was come back round to partially reframing it with my sister. I don't think that is my ego. I kind of just think it's my confidence. And I've invited my sister almost to try and understand me better and say, speak my language almost, because when I hear convincing arguments, and maybe I do need to work to be a bit more open and a bit more accepting of other people's opinions and what they're saying. But when I hear convincing arguments, I always let them in, because I'm seldom trying to be correct. I'm more just trying to convey my opinion. And I feel like for someone to get through to me, they'd have to change that. And oftentimes when it doesn't happen is when I think my stubbornness comes through, and when I think people feel like they're butting up against this ego.
I think being arrogant when you're defending your own beliefs, I think that's fine, because presumably if you have these beliefs, you think they're true. Mm. So in one sense, you do think that you're right and the other person's wrong.
Mm.
I think this is normal, and I agree with you in that this is not your ego. Mm. This is just the way in which you perceive your own views. Mm. The ego, like we were just saying, tends to just act in its own self-interest. So when this is negative, if you're actually defending your views, you are acting in your own self-interest. So maybe I'm wrong there. And it is egotistical to do that.
Have you had experience with this, Roshan?
Well, I was just
strong-minded, stubborn.
I was just thinking, I think I'm the opposite in the sense that I'm very quick to back down in an argument or when I have conflicting views with someone. I think, like, it's very much the case that I'll just kind of accept what they're saying and just kind of take it in. But I think that's maybe another example of a male and female ego difference.
Yeah.
I think as a woman, it's very easy if I defend my beliefs for someone to come and say, oh, you're just being stubborn, you're being bossy. And I think especially like in uni, when even when it's like a, it could be a like, what's the word? Even when it's about something academic, that's like could be very much a right or wrong thing on my course, I think it's very much the case that will the guys tend to argue more and the girls will sit back and just listen and back down. So I think, yeah, there's a difference there. I don't know. I think it's self-serving in the sense that I don't want to come across as bossy or I just, it would be tiring and stressful for me to get my point across in situations like that.
Okay.
I don't think...
And it's not intrinsically, all of this is not intrinsically linked to the ego.
I think so. I think, well, it's not the ego as such. I think it's that male sense of confidence.
Mm-hmm.
It's trying to pinpoint whether that comes from whether men have a part, just a stronger part that's more confident than a female one, or whether it is that sense of self that comes with being a man.
Okay.
Is it, sorry, is it not just disagreeableness or, well, and because it's disagreeable, it then leads on to confrontation. And this is something which men have in their personality, which women don't. Women are more likely to be agreeable. You're right in that it's not necessarily part of their ego. It's just part of who they are. As men, disagreeable, and as women, agreeable. And it's very easy then to conflate that with saying that, well, because this person, a man, is disagreeable and confrontational, therefore they have a big ego. I don't think that's necessarily the case. Because there are some people who, in my experience, are agreeable and they won't contest you and they won't be confrontational. But I also think they do have an inflated sense of self-importance. And just because they don't exhibit it in the same ways, it's clear to me that there is something going on there. They perceive themselves in a certain way, and it just doesn't manifest perhaps in the same way that men manifest their self-importance.
I almost think I became more agreeable the more effort I put into rejecting my ego. And I had to manage that to some degree because I do think there was an almost a sense of entitlement to my views. There was almost just an innate confidence and faith that what I was saying was correct. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been saying it. And that never really left me. But the more... I don't know. The more I abandoned the sense of self and the sense of being confident and correct, the more I was able to start to be moved and my perspectives were able to start to be moved in conversations. And I think I developed into just seeing a lot of what people said is interesting viewpoints. And I remember Roshan with you. I remember just speaking about conversations we were having and speaking about how at times I wasn't quite able to understand what you were saying because there were interjecting viewpoints being thrown across. And I'd say that's one of the things I'm most grateful for, being able to being able to better just accept what people are saying and try and run with that rather than, okay, Eunice has got his view. Eunice needs to get his view across. Eunice needs to convince. But that is an interesting point about the agreeableness and the disagreeableness. Because I've never known where I stood. In certain respects, I can be very agreeable. And in certain respects, I can be very disagreeable. But I have seen a link to this mysterious ego that we're talking about and how, in rejecting that, I do believe I've become more agreeable. You had a question.
Yeah, I was going to say, Adam, because you said something about women being agreeable. and men being disagreeable, and that just being ingrained in their personalities.
Cumulatively, if you look at the distribution, is it that men are more inclined to average slightly higher on the disagreeable scale, and women, there's still a lot of variance, if I'm understanding it the same way that you are. As a gender, typically the most disagreeable people would be male, and their average, male's average, are just slightly higher with a high distribution.
So it's, for the most part, men and women are the same, but where they differ at the extremes, you have the men who are very disagreeable and the women who are very agreeable. So on the whole, yeah, it tends to be that men are agreeable, women, sorry, men are disagreeable, men are, and women are agreeable. This is just one of many personality traits, and unfortunately I'm not a psychologist, so I'm not, you know, well up on my literature, but
We are going to circle back around Roshan. I was intrigued to hear of a time where these little Roshans have been positive, these little selves created in response to, I don't know, a situation or an occurrence, have actually been positive.
Yeah, I think there's definitely some I can think of. So a very negative part of me was one that felt very responsible for people that I shouldn't feel responsible for, like how they're acting or their behaviour. And I think I was able to transform that into a part that feels very responsible for my friends, which I think is a very positive part. I know lots of people might see it as overprotective or as a negative part, but I think it's a positive part of me that I actively check in with and make sure is okay and is like still going and still doing things. I like that part and I want that part of me to stay. I think there's also a part of me that's quite insecure. And I think in a lot of settings it's a negative part. Like it, there are lots and lots of times that it's very, very negative. But I can see from myself that everything that part is doing, that insecure part is doing, is just trying to make me feel more comfortable in myself. And it has a very negative response to other people's behaviour towards me. And it kind of turns around and says, no, like, Roshan, we're going to get all of our validation, everything we need from the inside and from yourself. So maybe insecure is the wrong thing to call it. It's what I like to call it. But I think it's a very positive part. I think it's a part that kind of helps me filter out all the noise from the outside world and only take in what's good for me and what will help me.
The same part that thinks a lot about your friends?
No, two different parts.
Two different parts.
Yeah, so they're two examples of two parts of me that I kind of have around and I'm aware of.
What I did find interesting is how much easier your way of thinking and viewing yourself made it to have positive self-talk. Because not every part of you is great and you have a good relationship with and you want to be there. And I think it was almost a liberating framework viewing it as, okay, this is a situational part of me that was birthed in response to a certain occurrence. And I'm allowed to want to part ways with that part of me, but that doesn't have to be me and it doesn't have to define me. And therefore, I don't actually have to hate myself when I see it in action. And I can instead convert my energy to just wanting to be rid of that part of myself.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's so natural for us as people, if one of our friends comes to us for help, or we see one of our friends acting out, or maybe doing something that's not good for them. I think it's so easy for us to have conversations with our friends and say, listen, like, what's up? What's wrong? Like, how are you doing? Like, are you okay?
Yeah.
I think this way of looking at things allows you to kind of do that with yourself. And you can take this part aside, and you from yourself can say, listen, like, what's going on? Why are we acting like this? I think it's a really positive way of thinking, and because it's so easy, it's so easy to have conversations about how other people are doing, and it kind of allows you to hold that mirror up to some of those parts.
Mm.
And also spend time with them, because I think a lot of the time we reject a part of us that we see is struggling. Maybe we're feeling super anxious one day. I think it's so easy for you to just put it in a box and be like, no, I'm not dealing with that today. I'm going to put it away. But if one of our friends was anxious, we wouldn't just lock them in a room and let them deal with it. I think it's so much healthier, and it can help so much if that sense of self, that you inside, takes that anxiety, holds it up and says, what's wrong? What can I do to help you? And I think the only way that you can be strong enough to do that without going to your friends for help or without putting on some TV that you know helps you, I think the only way you can do that is if you have a bigger ego and you have a more inflated sense of self.
Okay. And you have a more inflated sense of self. I'm not sure if I quite follow that last
part. That last part.
The only way, maybe I'd go to Adam and just be like, right, Adam, I'm just ridiculously anxious. Can you sit down and have a nice hot mug of hot chocolate with me? Is if I had a bit more of a sense of self.
If Adam, let's treat Adam as your sense of self and you as this anxious part that's struggling today.
Yes.
If Adam had no voice and Adam couldn't speak or didn't know where he was or who he was, he wouldn't be able to help you very well at all. It's the same with your sense of self. If you have no idea who you are if you have no idea who you are in yourself without the external world, if you have no sense of self, how can you help yourself in those situations where parts of you are struggling?
And so I need to be able to see through a lot of these smaller situational parts, maybe that have been birthed from trauma, and kind of just know who I am fundamentally, so I can give them a little pep talk or put them back in their place.
Yeah, exactly.
If I'm trying to rid myself of these small parts, what is left at the end of that process?
I was thinking there's
a lot of them. There's almost an infinite amount that you could create for yourself. Maybe they're already there. Maybe this is just a lens. In response to almost everything that has happened. And I'm trying to think, I've seen a lot of benefit in getting rid of them. But what is left at the end of that process? If I'm looking at me as a construct of situational unices, that maybe someone complimented my t-shirt and there was a positive unice, maybe someone said you look a bit fat and there was a negative unice, once I strip all of those back, what's left?
I don't think it's a case of getting rid of the parts at all.
No.
Because I think they're very important. They essentially make up what you present to the outside and how you act every day when you do, because you are going to have, the outside world does exist. You can't pretend that it doesn't.
Yeah.
I think it's not a case of getting rid of the parts. I think it's a case of just like nurturing them and making them feel okay with what they are. Like, yes, sometimes I do feel insecure, but I know myself. Sometimes there's an insecure part that gets really loud and starts screaming and shouting. But if I myself can just sit it down with a mug of hot chocolate, like you said, and just say it's going to be okay, I think that's good enough, because I think that insecure part is a part of me, like my hand or foot would be.
Okay. And it's here to stay? Just as long as we have a healthy cooperative relationship?
Yeah, for sure. I think your parts don't ever disappear. I think there are things you can do that would make them feel safer and make them feel more comfortable, but I don't think you can ever get rid of them.
That does chime quite nicely with how I've been thinking, especially when I've been trying to do my writings in the morning. And in one of the last articles that I was writing about my values, I just came to the realization that I don't think this personal development thing is all about just an intentional pursuit of changing yourself. I kind of do think, for me, it's just been becoming aware of what parts of yourself are present, what parts of yourself you like and dislike, and maybe when they fire. And to hear you say it shouldn't be about removing said parts of yourself, and in fact you can't, I think does sit very nicely with how I've been thinking recently.
It's peculiar because I don't actually perceive myself in the same way that you do. I don't feel like I'm made up of parts that respond in different situations.
Mm-hmm.
I only ever see myself as just a complete personality. I don't even think that I would put on different personas in different social groups. So for example, you often hear people say that, oh, I'm not myself when I'm in front of my parents, or I'm a completely different person. I feel like I'm exactly the same person. The only difference perhaps is that I moderate myself. So I'm not kind of splitting myself up into different parts. I'm just maybe not opening the door quite as far as I would when I'm with my friends. But I feel like I'm the same person. And I think your point about, well, if we're made up of all these small parts, what is there except these parts? You know, if we got rid of the parts, is there going to be anything left? Well, there must be something. There must be something that underpins all these different parts of ourself, a true self, an identity. And this, again, comes back full circle. Is this not what we mean when we talk about the ego?
Yeah.
This abstract self. So I don't think it serves any purpose to split up your ego. Maybe the ego helps you compartmentalize your different personality traits. But the ego itself is something which is abstract. It's like we were saying, your true self. Your true self. So if there's a part of you which is anxious, and you can talk to this part, and there's a part of you which is whatever, overconfident, that's fine, but the process by which you have these conversations is through with your ego. It's the thing which allows you to introspect.
Yeah, exactly. That's kind of, yeah, you have that inner self that is your ego, that you can separate from your parts. And kind of, I think without a sense of ego and a sense of self, I don't think you could really develop or live healthily. I think everyone needs that inner self. And I think everyone has them, but to different extents.
I think for me, maybe when I'm viewing these selves as separate to me, is in a lot of my internal dialogue, I would find myself saying, I'm feeling this. Maybe I'm feeling angry, or I'm being anxious, rather than I am angry and I am anxious. So I think, yeah, I kind of do view myself as a whole, but maybe the passing influences within me, I've come to adopt your view as there's these little parts of me, these little people, these little Eunices, that have different influences and different personalities almost. And I'd say previously, Adam, I think I was much more down your line of thinking. And I have actually found it very liberating. And I found it to almost break down such a rigid sense of self. Because I'm allowed to think and feel uncharacteristically when I don't need to reevaluate my whole sense of self just because I'm not a very anxious person, just because I'm feeling anxious. This is just a little potentially temporary part of myself that comes into being. And one of the domains I found that helped me out the most has actually been just in openness and vulnerability, because it's not something I'd say I was very good at 5 years ago, but almost in doing away with a sense of self, Eunice is this, Eunice has to be this, I allow myself to give off less representative projections. So I allow myself to come running into Roshan's arms crying because I just failed uni and my life's a mess. It's never happened, obviously. But I don't need to think, hold on, I'm Eunice, this is Eunice. Eunice has to be Eunice all the time. I'm allowed to just show different parts and parcels of myself situationally, which I'm very grateful for. So the final point I think I wanted to make was one literally on having an overinflated sense of self, being too attached to this sense of self and making everything about me. And I think the first time this properly became apparent was, or I realized it, was when I was writing an article called Show That You Care. And this was looking at a narrative in my childhood that I'm very grateful for my mum giving to me. And that was basically saying, show that you care. That love and affection isn't just a claim, it's an action, it's a verb. You have to back those things up. And the article was being grateful for that and also rejecting it. Because after a while, I realized that sentiments like show that you care, sentiments like if you truly cared about me, if you loved me, you would do X, Y, and Z. And the fact that you're not says a lot about how you view me. Fundamentally, they were hugely detrimental to myself. And the last twist on my views on that was when I'd been using that, I think it was an overinflated sense of self. Making everything about me, I think, was robbing me of the opportunity to kind of just take things how they were and to look at other people and the way maybe they're inclined to show that they care and the situations that they're in that may or may not be conducive to them doing or saying or being how I wanted. And the more I started to think through that lens, the more I realized I think I can orchestrate my own demise a lot when everything's about me. Again, when Adam's side eyes are because he hates me so much. And it's definitely been something that I'm trying to rid myself of. But to what extent, I'm still not too sure about. Because it's very liberating when not everything has to be the universe out there to spite you. But then again, I think both of you touched on it. Where really do you take yourself when we don't have a sense of self? Can I feel good about myself if every time Roshan pays me a compliment, I'm like, oh, no. No, Eunice, you're not actually that great and whatnot. And I'm wondering if either of you have had experiences, maybe romantically, maybe friendship-wise, making things too personal or making things too impersonal.
I've definitely had experience of making things too personal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's definitely something I'd actively want to stop in relationships.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that comes not from my sense of self.
No?
No, I don't think that comes from my sense of self, but again, a part of me that needs someone else to show me that they care. Okay. So it's quite different.
Okay.
To
maybe how that I was feeding, going about it.
Yeah, that feeding the ego. I think it's feeding a part rather than the self.
Because have you seen that be negative? Because for me, I was saying like my claims of if you felt this way about me, you were just X, Y, and Z. I could see, not in the moment, but after a while, it was glaringly obvious that that was just self-jeopardizing. It just closed my eyes to how they were showing that they care. It was just unrealistic expectations. And it was projecting a lot of my insecurities into these circumstances. And I'm wondering, maybe if you didn't see that dynamic in that way, it was more about, did you just have some intrinsic needs that need to be met? Was it detrimental? Has it been detrimental to you in that way?
I think it only became detrimental when I didn't realise it was happening.
Okay.
I think.
It was only detrimental when you didn't realise it was happening.
Yeah.
Like, for example, if someone doesn't message you back, it's very easy to fall into the, they don't care about me, they don't respect this friendship, they don't this, they don't that. And it always, for me, comes back down to me. It's never, they just had a very busy weekend, or simply, for no reason, they just haven't messaged me back. It's a, they don't care about me, or I'm not interesting enough, or I'm not worthy enough. And I think bringing everything back to me, I'm not employable enough. That's why it's my second year without an internship or a job or whatnot, just orchestrates my own demise.
I think the important point in all of this is to remember that you're only ever responsible for your own actions and your own activity. So when something else happens which is out of your control, which someone else does, there is no use in worrying about it and jumping to conclusions, because you're right, it's nothing to do with you, really. You can't control someone else's behaviour. You shouldn't. And if someone ever says to you, if you love me, you do this. If you care about me, you do this. Well, this is, I see it as emotional blackmail, to be honest.
Definitely.
It's funny because whilst they're making it about you and saying, well, if you care about me, you do this, actually what they're doing is precisely what we're talking about. They're making it about them.
Yeah.
And everyone's different in the way that they behave, or they show affection, they show that they care about people. Some people aren't very good at it. So you just need to let people offer up that themselves. And if they're not very good at it, you shouldn't pressure them, and you shouldn't make it about you. You should give them the space and the time to offer it themselves.
And one of the best ways I think I was able to overcome that myself is just a general easing of my sense of self. And part of that, it was quite instrumental when I sat down and realised it, is again not being responsible for absolutely everything. Like, one of the things I wrote in another article was, I'm not my past. I'm not my trials. I'm not my tribulations. I'm not my achievements. I'm not my biography. I'm not my present. I'm not what I find myself doing or saying. I'm not my competencies, nor am I my current circumstances and my privileges. And similarly, I'm not my future. I'm not my potential. I'm not what will happen. I'm just a human being. And it was liberating in a sense, because when I lose my whole sense of self, when everything doesn't just cling to me and bog me down, things do feel a lot better. But similarly, you can lose your sense of self when everything is impersonal. I've had good conversations with good friends where I've been shocked because they'll say, oh, she never really cared about me, or he never really cared about me, or surely I'm just so irrelevant. I think taking this narrative a bit too far. And I think what I'm trying to do at this point is strike a healthy balance. It's just strike a healthy balance.
I think I see things as kind of the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
I think when everything becomes super impersonal, and you don't take anyone's actions, and you reject the entire world, I think that's an overinflated sense of self. rather than a loss of sense of self. I think losing your sense of self is letting all of those things get to you, letting how someone else is acting get to you. Because if you had a sense of self,
okay,
you could say, no, actually, like, I'm enough for me. These things don't matter.
The sense of self that isn't riddled with insecurity, is that what it is? Because if I was secure in myself, I wouldn't be responding to Roshan replying to my messages 4 months down the line thinking, well, any number of things.
Mm.
That is very interesting. I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, I think your ego is how you feel when, or how it feels for someone not to reply to you and you to not care at all. I think that's what it's like to have a big ego. If Eunice, you were to like say some horrible things to me and I just didn't care, that's my sense of self just rejecting you and me just moving on and have it not affect me.
Is it not detrimental, though, to always let things affect you? Like if someone said something degrading to me or insulting, and I took it badly and I actually gave credence to what they were saying, it would really negatively affect me. But thankfully, I don't do that. Quite often, I completely ignore how other people perceive me because I am so confident and self-assured.
Mm.
If it means I have an ego, in my mind, so be it, because I'm better off for it, I think.
I agree. I don't think it's a bad thing to have a big ego. I think it can get dangerous when it comes to, like you said, it gets completely, you are just living your life with no cares in the world. I think that can be, it can get to be a dangerous thing, but I think to have a big ego and to have a large sense of self, I don't think that's a bad thing to have.
Because in a sense, it's what people are getting at when they say you know yourself.
You're not trying
to be anyone else. That is interesting because we've just gone full circle. And I now think I understand a bit better what you're saying when me having to draw on the confident Eunice, the ego Eunice, isn't necessarily myself or isn't necessarily my ego. And it's very interesting that the route to, knowing myself, maybe being full of ego, full of assuredness, came from trying to reject it in the first place.
Thank you again for joining us over at the Personal Development Project. Things have slowed down a tiny bit due to the transpiring COVID situation, which has made recordings a little bit harder. But I am seeking to find the safest way to keep the Personal Development Project ticking over. I do not know which will come next, but hopefully soon you'll be graced with either an episode on the power to change and our responsibility to do so, or a general episode on finding ourselves and our path. If you'd like to get involved, as ever, we invite anyone at all, to do so by heading over to our website at www.pdproject.co.uk. And until you hear from me again, I wish you a very pleasant day. See ya. It's a different kind of pain. It's a different kind of pain. Crafting your happiness. Crafting your happiness. It's a different kind of pain.